This is an Audio Wool original.
Sam, it's you. It's your turn.
Killed it.
That was bad.
It is Fright Day. I'm your host, Byron. Your mother sucks cocks in hell.
Okay, no,
the iconic and antagonistic line verbalized by a young Linda Blair in her role as Reagan in the 1973 possession smash hit The Exorcist, a film based on William Peter Blatty's book of the same name, directed by a man named William Friedkin, whose other notable works include The French Connection and more recently Killer Joe. What you may not know is that this Chicago-born director cut his teeth directing gritty made-for-TV documentaries in the 60s. Tonight, worlds collide and also come full circle as we review Friedkin's possession documentary The Devil and Father Amort and Delivery to Tragedy to Ceremony to E.T.
Yes!
Tonight we close the lid on Professional Naughty Boy. It's part three of Aleister Crowley in this week's edition of Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracies. I'm joined tonight by Kelly.
All roads lead to aliens.
And Sam.
Hey guys.
Hellishly busy week.
Yeah.
It's been a week.
Things happen.
Has it been for you guys? I mean, listeners, has it been busy
maybe
for you too?
They can't
hear you.
Answer you. We should take some live calls.
And let's go to the phone.
Hello?
Okay. Just email us, contact@frightday.com. I want to hear about your week. I tried to watch Handmaid's Tale 4 times. Fell asleep. Every time.
Ooh.
And not because it's bad at all.
You're just sleepy.
Pretty exhausted. In fact, I've seen the first 15 minutes of season 2. It might just be the best 15 minutes of TV I've seen all year.
Really?
Really intense, amazingly shot. And the way they've built the world in Handmaid's Tale, it's the perfect sci-fi dystopian future TV series ever. I love it. I
wow.
love Elizabeth Moss. What's that film, The Queen of Earth, I keep pushing?
A Week at the Lake.
Who the hell are you?
Me, Rich.
He likes to hang out sometimes.
Relaxation, peace and quiet, but under the surface lurks emotional imbalance.
See, Catherine is this great artist, but she's hiding in her father's shadow.
An imbalance that tears open psychic wounds.
Please don't talk to me like that.
Like what?
Like you're superior to me or any of us.
And threatens to shake the very foundations of sanity.
Heard you walking around super late last night. Sound like you were talking to yourself?
I feel sick. I feel messed up.
Well, we should trade places. See how we feel then.
I could murder you right now and no one would ever know.
Yeah.
From like 3 or 4 years ago that you've still never seen?
It was only like 2 years ago.
Well, I still think you should check it out. And if you haven't seen The Handmaid's Tale, have you? Do you?
No.
You don't do it.
I've been told by a friend that it's too much for me.
It's a lot. Oh, and it would be. You're right. And you can't
yeah.
watch it.
Trigger yeah. warnings for Kelly.
My BBF said, Kelly, this is not for you.
But Sam should watch it.
And I trust her.
I think you did.
I can't even get Sam to watch the things that I want him to
All
watch.
Right.
Which is
accurate. The first thing you got to do is maybe...
Westworld's top of the list.
Well,
sorry.
Westworld, you don't need to watch it.
I mean, that's not happening.
This first episode of Westworld didn't sell me on it. I don't know.
Were there robots?
There were.
Okay.
I just don't know if it hit me the same way that first season did. At the end of every episode during the first season, I left jaw open, eagerly awaiting the next episode. I didn't feel that this time.
Really?
Yeah.
You sure it wasn't your mood?
I mean, I had, like I said, extremely exhausted.
It's been a week,
so maybe next week I'll feel better about it. But I was I was kind of disappointed. I felt like, and I'm not a dumb person.
No, you're not at all.
The show tends to play with timelines a little bit.
Yeah.
They just left far too few breadcrumbs in this first episode to make it.
Oh, I love it. that. Well, they're really going to make us work for it? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, but you shouldn't have to work that hard.
I like working that hard.
I don't know.
I prefer really easily digested media.
Yeah, no, that just makes me want to prove myself.
Like Harry Potter.
Okay.
Like something that you don't have to think about. It's just
don't
oatmeal
talk,
of the
don't
brain.
Don't talk-ish about Harry Potter because that's seems not going to work for me.
Yeah, was
just, Sam doesn't like to work hard.
I don't like to work hard.
Sam had to work real hard this week. Sam and my best friend painted a giant
room
in our house.
Temporary studio.
Oh, yeah. It sounds different because, I mean, rooms do sound different.
Rooms do sound different. Do you think the paint color when we move back in is going to make things sound different?
No, absolutely
not. Because I think dark gray sounds different than red.
I think the stainless steel sheeting is going to make it sound different.
We don't have stainless steel sheeting.
Oh, it's coming tomorrow.
Oh, no.
No, that's not happening. Oh, but we are going to have wood floors. So the floors are going to be different.
Yeah, it's going to bounce a bit.
It's going to bounce.
So thanks for ruining the show. Okay, relax. Okay.
Thanks for ruining the show.
Again?
Still.
Oh, okay.
So lots of work. I'm, I guess, approaching the finish line of a project that I've been working on all year, the MISCON International Short Film Festival, which I'm the, I mean, I'm the director of it.
Mr. Manager?
No, I'm not.
There's always money in the banana stand?
All right, relax. I just want to briefly mention, if you're a short filmmaker who makes short films less than 30 minutes, preferably less than 20 minutes, in the genres of horror, sci-fi, or fantasy, go to filmfest.byronmccoy.com, submit your film, use the waiver code FRIGHTDAY. I want to see your stuff. That's all I got to say about that. What are you doing right there?
Writing a line for my report before I forget it.
Okay,
I just had a genius thought.
Oh,
and
no.
I went,
oh no.
All right, just making sure.
Kelly has pearl there that she pried out of the oyster of her misfiring brain.
Relax. I watched a really, really strange found footage film. Very excited to talk about it. It's called Be My Cat, a film for Anne.
Hello, Anne. My name is Adrian. I'm from Romania, and I want to make a movie with you. I saw you in Dark Knight Rises, and I saw you playing that Catwoman, and you're my actress. I even convinced three Romanian actresses to play in this film to show you how I'm gonna work with you on Be My Cat, on the movie that I want to make with you. They don't know, I lied to them.
The actress needs to be skinny.
And I'm not skinny enough for you.
No.
How can you say that I could have tried when the start, the something got, I forgot the lyrics.
It's not possible.
Oh my god, fuck, you're a shit actress, you know that? No,
because I can't run, you talk about
you don't want to find a solution.
If you don't leave me, I call the police, and your goddamn movie will not ever be made, okay?
Don't get it wrong, Anne. Please. Please understand this, okay? You have 20 seconds to give me one last word and then I will close the camera. Change the world with you, Anne.
I don't like anything about this so far.
It's written, directed, and starring a Romanian filmmaker named Adrian Tofi. Following witnessing actress Anne Hathaway's performance as Catwoman in The Dark Knight Rises, he decided to make a documentary to entice her to be in his upcoming project.
No.
He hires three actresses that resemble her in an effort to prove that he's a brilliant filmmaker. He lives at home with his mom.
How old is he?
This seems like the saddest thing ever. I want nothing to do with it.
He's a bald 30-year-old gentleman.
Awesome.
These people he hired, their performances don't quite live up to his expectations.
So he kills them?
It's basically Creep with just a touch of August Underground. Unbelievably unhinged, disturbing performance by Adrian. If you're looking for something a little north of normal, give Be My Cat, a film for Anne, a shot, which will be available, it's today, April 27th.
Humdinger.
Should check it out. Have you guys been watching anything lately?
I've been painting the house.
Not watching the backs of your eyelids.
No.
That means you're not sleeping much.
No. I did watch something.
Oh.
I watched something. You guys remember how last year... No. This is actually real.
Her excitement.
Byron, I'm going to tell you right now that this actually has more of a connection than anything I've reported on in recent history.
Wow.
So I believe it was last year Phoenix Forgotten came out and we watched that. It had to do with the Phoenix Lights incident, one of my favorite UFO stories. Mm-hmm. I was surfing through paranormal fiction films the other day and I came across the Phoenix incident.
In 1997, you took part in one of the largest military cover-ups in United States history.
That's correct. They've been here before. That was in Mosaka, Roswell. Those are recon missions. But Phoenix was different.
All across the state of mysterious flying objects in the sky,
and what many are already calling the largest UFO sighting in North America.
Congress doesn't even know if this happened.
Oh, man! Anything like this?
What's that one behind? That one there.
They were testing our weakness, testing our capabilities. It was only the beginning.
And I thought to myself, this sounds slightly like Phoenix Forgotten, but not quite. So I decided to take a watch. Now, here's the deal about this movie, guys. It is a found footage film.
Okay.
It was made in 2015, so very similar time frame.
Wait, we gotta talk about this. The noise you just made?
What?
Ugh.
Do you not like found footage films?
Not any. They're like zombie films. They've all been done.
I mean,
yeah, well,
I guess he's a bummer.
This one hadn't been done. It was pretty fun. The story surrounds four young men who go out into the desert around the same time that the Phoenix Lights happen. They're on some bro trip of sorts. They stumble into trouble because of the Phoenix incident, we shall call it.
Is there trouble government?
Yes, it's government related. It's also, I'm not going to give it away,
don't
related.
Worry about it. Mm-hmm.
But it takes place on March 13th, 1997. It was the day of the whole incident. I really was digging this movie. So I'm about 45 minutes into it. We've got some incredibly interesting storytelling, above par acting for found footage.
Okay.
Dark room, face blocked out, government interviews going on, interspliced with the footage. And then things took a turn. Anybody who listens to this show more than a couple times knows that I hate when horror movies show too much. This was a perfect example of if they had just kept it a little more hidden.
The triangle ships?
No, the triangle ships were stellar.
I think she's talking about what's on the ships.
I'm talking about what's on the ships. Okay. And they showed way too much. This could have been very, very scary. There's a pretty cool viral marketing campaign that accompanied this movie, though. In fact, the viral marketing campaign had a lot more impact than the movie itself. The U.S. Department of Justice and Arizona military officials investigated the filmmakers. So did The Mirror, which is a British tabloid,
mm-hmm.
Yahoo News, and the Business Standard, which is an Indian English language daily newspaper. They reported some of the viral marketing stuff as real news events.
Because they're dummies.
So high five to these guys for their marketing program. They did a great job. I think it's still worth watching. Just know that the first half of the movie is killer good, in my opinion. In fact, one of the best found footage I've seen probably the last 5 years. And the second half takes a nosedive.
Even when they're duct taping camcorders to their helmets?
Actually, the way that the story was told, that made perfect sense.
Yeah.
In the context of the story, they were basically trying to do GoPro stuff, but it was pre-GoPro.
It was 97.
Right. I think the way they did the video stuff worked perfectly.
Cool.
Yeah. I don't want to give away too much, but suffice to say, the way they did this movie was very, very interesting. Mm. It's worth watching for the first half alone. Just know that it's going to go south and then enjoy the humor when it does.
I'm looking at the Wikipedia page and it looks like the cinematographer's name is Brandon Cox. Click on his name and it takes me to Brandon Cox, the former American football quarterback.
Wikipedia has been doing funny things tonight.
But get this, guys.
What if it was?
He was born on October 31st.
I mean, very well could be the same guy. I don't know why you automatically assume that a football player couldn't also be a cinematographer.
I don't know what that makes me.
I don't know what it makes you either.
Just a good guy. All around good guy.
Check it out, guys. Super fun. Super, super, super fun.
Where'd you watch it?
I knew you were going to ask that. I'm pretty sure it was on Amazon Prime.
Okay.
It was either Amazon Prime or Netflix, but I'm almost positive it was Amazon Prime. I told you it was a real one. I actually watched a real, like, a genre film. You proud?
Pretty all right.
Proud?
Well, not proud.
Proud.
Because it is the...
You sat through that.
Proud.
It's kind of the baseline of what we do here.
I also watched the first half, Operation Avalanche. I'd heard such terrible reviews that I'd never seen it.
Mm-hmm.
Really impressed with it. And I said, I'm going to stop this because I'm going to watch the whole thing with Sam because it's worth watching.
Yeah, the way they filmed that is amazing.
Yeah.
And we should do that for Moon Month.
We should. Duh. Yeah. Why do you think I was watching it, B?
Well, I'm just thinking we maybe should even...
Oh, like do it for one of the movies? Okay.
Yeah. We should do it
done.
For Turkey.
Perfect.
For Turkey Month.
All right.
But it has nothing to do with Turkey. Sam, it's the moon.
Well,
I don't know how I forgot about this. My brain is mush this week. We actually watched the first few episodes of The Terror on AMC.
You must wonder what we're doing here in your part of the world. are from England, very far away. We've come here to find a way through to China and India.
Now is our moment to stride into our glory and to our destiny.
Our situation is more dire than you may understand.
That is how you already see it. In need of saving.
I do.
Our men have been out there in unimaginable temperatures. No one can convince me that optimism or confidence is warm enough.
As a trusted friend once put it, this place wants us dead.
Actually, we only watched the first one episode. It was just an hour and a half long.
It's a big one.
Whoa.
Okay.
I love this book. The Terror is a novel by Dan Simmons. It's kind of speculative fiction horror about a 19th century expedition to find the Northwest Passage.
Icebreaker ships, right?
Yeah, yeah. The HMS Erebus and the HMS Terror set out to find a route basically north of North America to facilitate trade between Europe and, I don't know, wherever you want to go from there.
Little did they know.
Yeah.
Flat Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Come on now, there's no getting around it.
Both ships end up locked in ice, and it is cold. And that was one of my favorite things about the book was I just could not get warm while I was sitting down for long periods of time to read this relatively weighty book. It's just, Simmons did an incredible job of putting you there as these poorly dressed, like under-equipped, ignorant sailors for the most part, trapped for months and years on the ice, just constant bludgeoning, terrible cold. Ugh. And they're not alone on the ice. I love this book. I read it probably, oh geez, almost 10 years ago now.
It came out in 2007.
Yeah, it was kind of my introduction to this whole expedition. And at that time, I did a bunch of research on it. And I just thought the whole thing was fascinating. Just man's both intrepid spirit to set out on an expedition like this. And also just the hubris of thinking that they could stand against the completely indomitable forces of brutal, uncaring nature.
At the edge of the earth.
At the edge of the earth, where the monsters come out from underneath when it's dark out.
That makes sense.
Because, like in that Marie Senlac book.
The sun revolves around us.
The sun revolves? Are you serious?
I apologize.
It revolves around me.
Ciarán Hinds is just absolutely one of my favorite actors, and he is amazing as Franklin. Jared Harris as Captain Crozier, who's the protagonist of the story, he's kind of the only one in command of this whole expedition that sees things the way they really are and not blinded by this idea of glory and conquest for crown and sees a really miserable way to die for a bunch of poor, unfortunate men under his command.
Yeah.
And I've talked about The Terror before on our show. It's one of the great mysteries of the age of exploration, what happened to Franklin's expedition. And Simmons speculated in The Terror, the novel.
And The Terror is the name of the boat?
Is the name of the ship.
The ship,
yep.
Okay.
Yep.
It's a bigger boat. Don't make yes. fun of me with your smart words.
Sorry. In 2016, the Arctic Research Foundation announced that the wreck of the Terror had been found.
New discoveries after an old search, one that started more than a century and a half ago after the ship was lost, leaving all 129 men on the expedition dead. The find is not surprising when you consider the other ship in the Franklin expedition, HMS Erebus, was discovered only 2 years ago. But the location of this latest discovery is a surprise. 24 meters underwater, in King William Island's uncharted Terror Bay, almost 100 kilometers south of where searchers expected it to be, raising the possibility sailors tried to escape danger by heading south. It's reportedly in perfect condition, with several window panes still in place.
So that has painted in some of the empty details Simmons was able to weave into his story, because now we know where these ships ended. I don't want to say anything else about what actually happened to the ships or what happened in the Terror, because you should watch this. It's a Victorian Gothic. It moves at its own pace, and it feels like something on Masterpiece Theater.
Really?
It's got that kind of lavish set design, brooding, sophisticated type actors. So far, it's just a great show. I'm loving it.
As a horror series.
Yes.
So far, yes.
Yes.
Remember where I said, they're not alone on the ice?
Mm-hmm. That sounds fun. Are we done with the first season? Are you just playing catch up? Or is it currently airing? It is currently airing.
Yes,
they've got four more episodes.
Four more to go.
And it is, I believe, a limited series.
I've been meaning to check that out since the trailer came out. Unfortunately, I don't want to hang out with my parents and watch AMC because they have cable, you know.
That's what parents do. They have cable and landlines, and we love them for it.
Fine, I love you, Mom and Dad. I'll come over and watch The Terror. That sounds like a great time. Hopefully no one on those boats abandons their shipmates.
No.
Kind of like a terrible man abandoned some people on the mountain several weeks ago.
Actually, just kind of chilled in a tent while they died.
Of course, we're talking about Aleister Crowley. What do you say we wrap this up, huh?
Woo-woo!
In this week's edition of Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracies.
Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracies.
Byron, I feel like last week I did a pretty good job of proving to you how evil Crowley could be.
I mean, you did a good job of proving to me how evil Crowley wanted me to think he was.
Okay, good. Well, that's what matters. That's what matters. But now my job this week is to prove to you and everyone else that the greatest thing Crowley ever did was summon a little feller named Lamb.
Do you want like a sound effect playing now or something? Like,
bah!
All right.
Bah! So, just kidding. January through March of 1918.
That was the worst goof you've done yet.
Crowley's living in NYC, Central Park West, which is interesting because this is actually very close to where I just was, in New York.
That's interesting.
Please start saying normal words.
Well, now I wish I would have gone and visited this location. I should have, but I was an idiot and didn't. The wild work he was doing revolved around a series of magical workings called the Alamantra workings. You can read all about these on Bibliotheca Pleiades, but holy cow, it's hard. I'm not kidding. Literally, white font, light gray background. Why? No idea why they would do that. I have no clue.
It's even worse than their neon green on black.
Yeah, so there's a lot about eggs. There's a lot about astral planes and about flying through astral planes. Lots of good stuff. Made no sense to me. But the point of these rituals was to bring certain intelligences, that has air quotes in it, you guys, intelligences into this world. His partner, Roddy Miner, a female, was a medium for most of these visions and discussions. So he's living in some furnished rooms, like I said, Central Park West, and there was some sexual and ceremonial magic with the K, the intent of invoking these intelligences.
Did you think he ever just makes love?
No.
Like, does it always
it's always magic.
Does it always
I don't think
have
it's his jam.
It's magic.
Yes, all I do think it does.
He's always magicking somebody.
Ooh, I have a sliver.
That is good radio.
The idea of this magic was to bring these intelligences, really.
He dropped his phone. He's okay.
Though the point was to bring these intelligences to physical manifestation, the workings, according to his notes at least, typically manifested a series of visions and communications that went through Roddy. However, one intelligence was brought into physical manifestation via the magical portal that they created. And it's important to know that a portal in this context is magically created by ripping the fabric of time and space. In this case, the entity that came through is the one pictured in the show notes of this episode at Friday.com.
Oh, yeah, you showed us this picture.
You huh. See that character? See that nice little lamb?
Well, doesn't look like a sweet lamb to me.
It's important to know that the entity either called itself Lamb or was named Lamb by Crowley. This could be because Lamb is known as the way in Tibetan Buddhism. And actually, in the Tibetan language, Lamb is the way, which is why Lama is the person who knows the way, the person who goeth, essentially. Mm-hmm. There are many reasons that this creature could be called Lamb, mm-hmm. but that's what he's known as. It was considered to be of interdimensional origin, which was the term then for extraterrestrial. However,
for people who haven't pulled it up on the website, we should maybe physically describe, I guess.
Oh, Byron or Sam, I would like one of you guys to physically describe it, please.
It's like a pencil sketch of a gigantic headed man, kind of like Max Headroom or the Coneheads,
or like something else.
I was thinking maybe like the storyboard to a Tool music video.
Okay, can you guys
but kind of like a Tick also.
He looks like a gray alien.
It looks like it could potentially be what could be misconstrued as yes. a gray well, alien. He's given him the side eye.
He's given him the, it's like the Mona Lisa gray alien, right?
Yeah,
keep this in mind.
It could make a nice enamel pin.
It would. I think it would be the most phenomenal pin ever. A lamb pin? Do it now. Okay. What's important about this is that in 1918, the gray alien was not a part of pop culture at all. So it's not like Crowley saw an X-Files episode and, hey, this is what I'm going to draw up. This is what I saw when I did my own sex magic. No, this was a completely fresh image, which makes it far more remarkable. Do you guys not understand that?
Well, you know what, though, Kelly? And this is interesting. Lots of people see this gray alien.
Yes.
Lots of people who have experiences with extraterrestrials. Maybe it's one of those things that's just ingrained in our
archetypal
brains.
It's a very good idea. You're talking Jungian psychology now.
Am I?
Yeah, you are. All right. We'll do an episode on Jung one of these days. Maybe we'll even do some somatic psychology.
That sounds a little more real than some of the stuff we do.
Well, it is pretty real. But so is this. And so is Lamb.
Wasn't it in 1893 H.G. Wells wrote about gray-skinned beings?
Nothing like this, though. We don't even know what color this was because it was a black and white pencil sketch. So we don't know what Lamb was.
He didn't have colored pencils.
Well, apparently not. Those were not allowed in sex magic.
Okay.
Both in Crowley's writings and supposedly in the rituals that brought Lamb forth, the symbolism of an egg featured prominently. Some people have speculated that the egg was actually the ship that Lamb traveled in, which I thought was pretty fun because if you've seen The Arrival. Egg-shaped ships?
Kinda.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily.
Like off-center, not perfectly symmetrical egg shape.
Yeah.
Which is pretty sweet. This was featured in the Dead Souls exhibition, which was held in Greenwich Village, New York in 1919.
You're talking about the image.
The image of Lamb. And then it was also published and labeled The Way in Crowley's commentary to Blavatsky's The Voice of the Silence. The only inscription beneath the picture was, Lamb is the Tibetan word for way or path, and Lama is he who goeth, the specific title of the gods of Egypt, the treader of the path. In Buddhistic phraseology, its numerical value is 71, the number of this book. So Crowley being super cryptic about things, that's just how he rolled. He did hand this actual drawing over to Kenneth Grant, which was one of his disciples, in 1945. This was just a couple years before he died. In 1955, Grant announced the discovery of a trans-Plutonian planet.
I just realized something really funny.
Oh, no.
I was looking at the side of the picture of the way, and there's a little signature on it. There's an initial, and I was like, that doesn't look like Aleister Crowley's signature that I've seen. So I pulled it up on Google search, and I realized something startling.
What?
Take a look at the A in Aleister.
It's a dick and balls.
Yeah, it's totally a dick and balls.
God, he's like a 5-year-old.
I actually have more respect for him now than I did before I knew that.
God, that's so... I want to get something out of Crowley's teachings, but instead Lamb is the only thing that I'm going to fixate on because I love it.
All right.
So Grant, his disciple, Crowley dies in 47. In 1955, Grant announces that he's discovered a trans-Plutonian planet called Isis, and he decided this was an important time to establish the new Isis Lodge of the OTO for the purpose of contacting higher intelligences. Then, in the late 1980s, so Grant's getting up there in years at this point, he starts receiving messages that led him to conclude that Crowley's portrait of Lamb could be used to provide a focus point for the extraterrestrial energy that had originally been invoked in 1918. You know, the idea is he was actually invoking some type of a transdimensional or extraterrestrial being rather than just some devil spirit occult thing. There are a lot of theories out there that try to unify the notion of devils and aliens. I've been reading more and more theories along those lines, and it doesn't entirely sound ridiculous to me.
It sounds a little like a revelation that William Friedkin comes to in the movie we'll talk about that
in a minute. But is it possible that by the time Grant was discovering all this in the 80s, someone else had already messed with Lamb and the portal? Well, it is possible. In fact, it's
probable.
Two of Crowley's unofficial students during his final years were, all right, guys, drum roll. Are you ready for this? This is the most interesting thing ever. Jack Parsons, who founded the Jet Propulsion Laboratories, complete genius. The second unofficial student was none other than L. Ron Hubbard. This was a few years before Dianetics.
That round-bodied.
Well, let's watch the language. These two gentlemen decided they were going to try and pick up where Crowley left off by messing around with this interdimensional portal, conduct some pretty intense rituals. Those who have investigated Thelema and other elements of Crowley's practices believe Jack Parsons might have been one of the most passionate practitioners when it came to the mother goddess. But Crowley and Jack disagreed. This super important practice. It's called the Babylon Working. Crowley basically told Jack not to mess with it. Jack was a bit rebellious and started digging into it. Crowley kind of wrote him off as a failure, but then he said he would have to remain open to the idea because he knew that Jack was working on the experiments and he had not yet received an expected report from him. So Jack conducted the Babylon Working in 1946. This is literally months before the end of Crowley's life, and supposedly invoked the goddess Babylon, an attempt to bring about the end of tyranny that had dominated mankind during the Dark Yuga. Now, I have no idea what that means, but I do know that the way in which he supposedly brought forth Babylon was, you guessed it, sex magic.
Mm-hmm, because, yeah. I mean, Babylon, also known as Ishtar.
Which is the best thing ever. God, I love Ishtar. Watch that movie. Everybody stop and go watch Ishtar, starring Dustin Hoffman and Warren Beatty.
Really?
Many people consider it to be one of the worst movies of all time, but like Clifford, it is fabulous.
I was going to say, those people haven't seen Clifford.
Yeah, goddess of war and sexual love. So makes a lot of sense.
Right. So the intention was they were going to use sex magic, create this child using a elemental, we shall call them. They would call down the spiritual baby and direct it into the womb of this volunteer. It's believed that the female involved was Marjorie Cameron, who Parsons ended up marrying down the road. It would grow like a normal baby and then incarnate the forces of Babylon, the Scarlet Woman of Revelations, which in occult circles was supposed to be the dawning of the Age of Horus.
These guys never actually listened to themselves talk, did they?
I mean, maybe they did. It is pretty impressive sounding, especially when they were doing drugs, I would imagine. But this Babylon Working would reopen the portal Crowley had been working on when he spoke with Lamb, and would also increase the portal's intensity, making it super unstable. This is why Crowley said, stay the hell away from this. This is way too much. You guys are treating this with far too little respect. You don't really know what you're dealing with. You're out of your element, Crowley kept saying to them, and they ignored. I don't know if you guys have thought about the time frame we're dealing with here yet, but this is what makes the story so damn interesting to me. 1946, spring, summer is when the end of these workings are coming about. This is almost a year to the day before the Kenneth Arnold sightings, the Roswell crash. So perhaps the Babylon workings opened up a portal through which those saucers flew, Kenneth Arnold saw, and through which some other crash occurred in Roswell. You know, looking at that is pretty interesting, and suddenly bringing all these occult practices and Thelema practices back around to the notion of really the onslaught of huge UFO sightings. What if there's a connection, you guys? What do you think?
Anything is possible. That's not.
Okay,
well, that's not cool.
I think Kenneth Arnold was drunk.
Oh, you stop it. Kenneth Arnold's like the most reliable witness ever. That's absurd for you to say.
He was flying curly cues and loop-de-loops in his little plane.
No, he wasn't. You stop it. Sam, don't be an idiot.
Throwing cans of Budweiser out the window.
I also think it's very cool that the way Crowley described Lamb to begin with was as an interdimensional being, which is what a lot of the theories about aliens are coming around to now, that they perhaps aren't extraterrestrial. They aren't traveling across time.
Us from the future.
They're either us from the future or us from another dimension, but they aren't actually coming through space. They're coming through dimension or time. I love that theory. And now I have a little poem for you.
Perfect.
I am Lamb. I am Lamb. Lamb I am. I am Lamb. I am that Lamb. I am. I do not like that Lamb. I am.
I knew it was going there.
Would you like green eggs and ham? I do not like them. Lamb. I am. I do not like green eggs and ham. Lamb. I am. Lamb. I am. I am Lamb.
I got an email. I got to take this.
I kind of like that. Now, you guys, I'm not going to lie. The story surrounding Jack Parsons' connections to rocket science and his death, one of the most fascinating, mysterious circumstances
Parsons
ever.
Parsons had a wild death.
Yeah, and we're going to have a separate episode on Parsons because there's no way we can cover that. And I really need to wrap up Crowley because I have to at least let people know how he died. So he died at Netherwood of chronic bronchitis, which was aggravated by pleurisy and myocardial degeneration, probably all caused by his very...
drugs.
Excessive lifestyle.
Yeah, he lived to the extremes. His funeral was held at a Brighton crematorium on the 5th of December. Only about a dozen people attended. Somebody read excerpts from the Gnostic Mass, the Book of Law, and the Hymn to Pan.
How many people showed up to his fake funeral?
Oh, when he said he died? That's a really good question. I don't know. Well, the Hymn to Pan was also read, and the Hymn to Pan comes back to Jack Parsons because apparently Jack Parsons recited the Hymn to Pan at every single rocket launch he was ever present for. something interesting going on there. For somebody who lived and influenced so many people, I do think it's interesting that there were so few around at the end of his life, though that's certainly something you hear with important people throughout history. Tesla. Yeah, although I really don't want to put Crowley and Tesla in the same category.
Yeah.
Sam would get upset about that. Apparently, Crowley's ashes were sent to Carl Germer, the chosen successor as the head of the OTO. Germer buried them in his garden in Hampton, New Jersey. So that's where Crowley forever rests. Anybody listening to this who's a Crowley fan or a Thelemite knows that there are countless elements of Crowley's life that we haven't touched on. We could probably do a full year of podcast episodes just on Crowley-related topics, but I chose to focus on some of the things that I thought were most interesting and most related to other Captain Kelly's cryptids and conspiracies. I will say, if you want a little bit more on the Thelemites and religion of Thelema to begin with, I would recommend checking out at least portions of The Secret History of Twin Peaks, because they do get into some of it there, and so, it ties back to Twin Peaks, folks.
Doesn't seem like the most efficient way to learn.
Well, but you should listen to that anyway or read it, because it's one of the best things that's ever been.
All right.
That's Crowley, guys. Crowley opened up a portal to aliens, which is why we get to talk about aliens now. And for that, Crowley, I will be forever thankful.
Thank you so much for that report.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thanks, you guys.
We've discussed magic. And we've discussed aliens.
And magic.
With a K, of course. It wouldn't be a Fright Day episode if we didn't talk about...
Demons?
You want to really just like go full out?
A little something for everyone.
Let's review The Devil and Father Amort.
Hope you're enjoying your visit here this evening. Now, on with the show.
The Devil and Father Amort. It's a 2018 documentary film directed by William Friedkin. Sam, can you tell me a little bit about this?
In 1973, he brought us the film classic The Exorcist. 45 years later, Academy Award-winning director William Friedkin brings us the real thing.
Well, about that.
Okay.
Okay, it was an exorcism.
It was an exorcism.
We saw an exorcism. Maybe we should rewind a bit. Talk about The Exorcist.
The Exorcist is one of the scariest movies of all time. Thank you, William Friedkin.
I love The Exorcist. I think they went a little bit overboard with the pea soup, because I don't like vomit in my films. But
oh, you don't?
It was excellent.
It gives me the willies.
Are you a sympathetic puker?
Well, I don't.
My best friend's a sympathetic puker.
I tend to feel sick when I see people get sick.
Yep.
I don't puke, but I do panic. Great film. Never read the book. Have you read the book?
No.
No one?
Uh-uh.
All right. I'm not really a fan of Blatty.
Blatty is an awful, garbage
he's dead,
human.
So.
Right. Well, what's Blatty's deal? What else has Blatty written?
The Exorcist 3, aka Legion.
Weird. It's the sequel, Legion, but it's The Exorcist 3?
Yeah.
All right. Sam, do you have feelings about that film?
About The Exorcist?
Yeah.
It was like one of the first horror films normies went to in droves, and it screwed them up. It was terrifying. It seemed so real at the time. The effects were amazing. Mm-hmm. It was transgressive. I mean, when Reagan is possessed, she is vile. Do terrible, terrible things. It was shocking. It was that element of the filth and perversion that goes along with what quote-unquote demons represent, not just the boo scary possess you stuff. But it was dirty, and it made it terrifying.
And it really brought just how scary the devil is into pop culture.
Yeah.
As much as the special effects and the exorcism stole the show, really it's about man's grasping for meaning and for, you know, a reason to believe. That's the battle that's at the core of it.
I mean, I think for religious people, it probably takes on a little different connotation, but
you're not religious.
I don't know many people who can watch The Exorcist and not be scared in some way, shape, or form. It's one of those universal. So here's an interesting thing about me, guys. I'm not sure I believe in the devil, but I'm afraid of him.
Okay. You don't think he's the pitchfork devil, though?
Oh, pitchfork. pitchfork. Sticky lures in the tuss.
Right.
Yep.
I like to think
Sorry, David Cross.
Well, excuse me?
Well, I can't use that without giving credit. I don't want people to think that I'm trying to pretend like that's mine.
Oh, okay. Tuss. All right, well.
The Exorcist scares me because it's unknown and it's uncontrollable and there's no defending yourself against it. Everything in that movie scared the hell out of me. And you guys incessantly mock any Exorcist film that we watch, like any movie involving an
Exorcist.
Because
none needed to be made after The Exorcist.
I don't necessarily...
It's become a bit of a cliche.
Well, it is a bit of a cliche, but I think it's a scary topic that deserves investigating. Sure. And someday somebody's going to do it well again.
Taking of Deborah Logan was a great example.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. I actually think The Last Exorcism was also pretty damn good. Good old Caleb Landry.
Yeah, that guy's fun.
What was the one with Joel McHale? That one was great.
No, that one was not great.
It was terrible. Well,
we went to the theater.
That was
that
As
one.
Above, So Below.
We did. We no, do that. We that do that for not. Our listeners.
Oh, great. That was a different one.
It
this
was
one.
The Devil's Breath.
I heard.
That
was a good title, man.
No, thanks. I don't know what it was, but it wasn't good.
Here's the thing about this movie. Friedkin sounds exactly like Trump, and it's hard to listen to.
Okay. So William Friedkin, I guess I have trouble figuring out what he even was trying to do with this movie. Starts out talking a little bit about the history of The Exorcist. He visits a couple locations from the film.
Which...
Well, I can tell you what he's trying to do. He was able to go in and film an actual exorcism, and he's trying to build a movie around it.
Yeah, frame a film around it.
Which he should cool. have here on these steps at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., blah, mm-hmm. blah, 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 blah. And shut up about it. You're flogging a dead horse. Like, you're a several trick pony.
Yeah, I was going to say, he actually made a lot of good movies.
Who has totally passed his prime, and he's to ride the corpse of his career right to the finish line.
Well, I think,
use that time to talk about what you're going to see, and don't just hammer on, I don't know. It was irksome and tiresome to me the way he didn't shut up about The Exorcist.
In his defense, I think one of the reasons he was doing that is to give people a frame of reference, because a lot of people of this generation haven't necessarily watched The Exorcist.
Mm-hmm. Why was he putting himself in front of the camera? So
because much? He was the one who went in to film.
Because that was his budget.
He needed to establish himself as a reliable narrator, essentially, sure. because he's the one that goes in and solo films this exorcism. Well, but just backing up a second, okay. You guys, Bug... Killer Joe,
yes.
French Connection, all really good movies. So let's give this guy some credit. Let's not just say he was a one-trick pony.
Well,
I do agree he seems
a
to
lot
have...
a huge gap between 1973 and 2006 when Bug came out.
Right. You know, I'm just saying he did a Tales from the Crypt episode. Blue Chips, I actually think is a really cool movie. I really enjoyed Blue Chips.
Nick Nolte.
Shaquille
O'Neal.
Yeah, I do think that he might have a little bit of an inflated ego, and perhaps that has something to do with how much screen time he has.
Also, he's hard to look at. His surgery was not good.
I don't care about looking at him. I care about listening to him, because the Trump voice is like really hard for me.
Okay, and all right to you as well.
Much better vocabulary, but still really difficult to hear.
How many more do I have to drop to?
I'm really sorry. Okay, all right. What bothered me about this movie is we didn't get a lot of backstory about the woman who's being exorcised, Christina.
For the ninth time.
That very well could be that she didn't want a bunch of her background in the movie. She may have not have signed off for that.
I think you should rewind a little farther. And Father Amore, he's this old doddering Catholic priest.
He's the founder of the International Association of Exorcists. He supposedly performed thousands of exorcisms. He has since passed.
Oh, he died a little bit after the filming of this.
Yes,
at
he did.
92 or something?
Yeah.
Full life.
There are questions as to how many exorcisms he actually performed, because the notion of thousands would be very difficult given how much time they take, and he probably would never have been able to do anything else. But
we need to clarify that when we say perform exorcisms, we mean that the exorcism was performed, not that there was something to be exorcised.
Well, we're not going to speak to that because we are not authorities, but...
Well, I think they can safely say that not all exorcisms, and in fact, a majority are unsuccessful.
I have no idea. If this movie is any indication, then yeah, they're almost all unsuccessful, because 9 times was not enough for poor old Christina. We've got this Father Amort. He allows Friedkin in to film The Ninth Exorcism of Christina.
Which is a good movie name.
It is. Now, what I liked about it is it showed the exorcism in a way that was a little bit more realistic. So there's no head spinning. You know, it's not as melodramatic as in the movies, which seems obvious.
But as a result, it's also extremely boring.
I disagree. You want to know why it's not boring?
Kelly, you were literally making a sandwich while you were watching The Exorcism.
I was actually cutting up
Byron
peppers.
And I sat there and watched the whole thing.
I was cutting up peppers and trying to eat something healthy.
Oh, okay.
But the point is, her voice makes it terrifying.
This is not fiction. It's different from all the movies.
All right. And are we going to get into that part?
I think, well, to me, that is the only part of the actual filmed exorcism that is unexplainable. The rest of it very well just could be a woman with a mental illness.
All right. Yeah, and it's just in this room with a bunch of people.
So back up. Ninth exorcism of Christina. We're in the room. Friedkin is only allowed to bring in his handheld camera, no light crew.
Which is a suspicious coincidence given his budget.
Sure, it is. Christina's in a room filled with her family. There's probably like over 10, 15 people in there.
It looks like a wake.
Sure.
Well,
except everyone's happy.
A lot of support.
She's squirming around and periodically growls and says very evil things as it's going on. And then other times is like very visibly, you know, I don't think she was faking it. Sure. I think it's what I would boil down to.
That this
20 minutes?
20 minutes, maybe.
Something like that.
15, 20. It seemed, I mean, it's hard to say, 15 to 20.
Like a long time. Very well could be. But this voice that came out of her.
The voice is the most important part. And I think that Matt Seitz on RogerEbert.com phrased it the best. He said, the guttural growls that come out of Christina are certainly unnerving, but it would have been wise for Friedkin to state on camera that the audio has not been manipulated in any way, because it sure sounds like something out of The Exorcist, which to me is the crux of the movie. Like, if it hadn't been manipulated, then this is freaking amazing.
Well, okay. So
and if it had been manipulated, then who gives a crap about this movie? But they just leave it unstated, which automatically leaves the viewer to assume that it's been manipulated.
Look at the timeline of what you're saying, though. He's never seen a real exorcism before.
Right.
Friedkin. But right. His film sounds like...
Well, but other people had... And keep in mind that his film was based on a book, sure, which was about a real exorcism, which I'm sure described the voices.
In this voice, I'll just do a quick effect here. Oh, I'm the devil.
Are you really going to do that? Kelly is amazing.
All right, and stop it.
But this isn't the devil telling you. It's a weird sounding angel.
Okay.
Okay, so that's that.
That's what that sounds like. And that's what she sounds like. It just seems to me like it was very obviously affected in some way. Yeah. Like whether they're doubling it and then like changing the octave or the pitch. Like,
it honestly seemed to me like all the other audio went quiet or mute immediately around. Like the background babble of all the people in the room.
It ducked.
Yeah.
Yeah. And basically every review, that this is what's brought up. Like, what the hell? That voice is terrifying. Was it altered?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it needs to be spoken to. Is the audio tweaked? Whether it's The Village Voice or The Atlantic or Rolling Stone or Vanity Fair, they're all asking the same question. And Fright Day is too.
Yeah. Friedkin.
Because that is the coolest part of this movie, and it is terrifying.
Well, don't say that, because then it puts a lot of pressure on him if he says,
well, it is.
I did mess with the audio. And then it's just a total garbage film, which honestly.
I mean, I hate to say this, and I don't mean to be disrespectful. I don't take anything away from the other films he's created. But if the audio was altered, then this is a complete garbage, pointless film. Because to me, all we've done then is film this poor woman with a very obvious mental illness. And that's it. After we see the exorcism, he's interviewing all these doctors, right? And they do have legitimate credentials. They're like neuroscientists from UCLA.
They all look mysteriously assaulted.
Beaten up. Yeah, it does look like he beat all of them up.
He is roughing up.
One of them had a black eye.
Professional
opinions. One of them had two Band-Aids on his face.
Yeah,
I mean, who knows what's going on? But the point is, like, all of them are talking about what they saw was super weird. And like, I don't know, maybe part of it could be explained by neuroscience. Maybe part of it couldn't. But they don't ever even discuss directly the voice. And if I were a freaking doctor watching this, that would be the first thing I discussed is, yeah, that voice is unnatural.
Sure.
Like, everything else I'm seeing is a person with some very severe mental disturbance. But that voice, I can't explain that voice, but it's never directly addressed. And it's like the elephant in the room the whole damn movie.
No, I completely agree. I don't know. Now I'm Googling if it's even possible to speak in multiple tones. I mean, obviously, you're implying that
it would be supernatural.
If this truly was, this would be a bigger deal than it is.
Well, it just came out. So who knows? Maybe it is a big deal, but I would like to hear. I'm hoping that Friedkin speaks to this, because I really would like to know. This voice is the only interesting thing about this movie.
If you come back next week and you have like a Band-Aid across the bridge of your nose and your eyes are black and you say that it is true.
It's true. It's true. I swear it's true.
I'll be very upset at Friedkin and his production team.
Yeah. Important to note that there are 4 exorcists in Rome, 300 around the world within the Catholic Church. And Father Amort says that many of them were trained by him. So whatever you believe about exorcisms and whether they're real or whether they're, you know, catering to something that's fake to begin with, it is a big deal, and Amort was at the center of it, you know, the modern practice of exorcism. So it's interesting for that reason. I shouldn't say the movie has no redeeming quality, but in terms of being scary, it's the voice.
I would have rather watched an entire documentary just about Father Amort, and not even necessarily showing any sort of wild supernatural things coming out of this exorcism, but maybe just talking more about the history of exorcism in general.
Well, and what a garbage person he actually was.
Quite possibly.
No, well, he was one of the people who was a foremost voice that Harry Potter attempted to make a false distinction between black and white magic when the distinction, quote, does not exist because magic is always a turn to the devil.
Oh, well, he just sounds like an old
and
man.
And he also says that yoga is satanic because it leads to the practice of Hinduism and, quote, all Eastern religions are based on a false belief in reincarnation and, okay, quote, practicing yoga is satanic. It leads to evil just like reading Harry Potter. And he also takes advantage of people who are clearly in need.
One of the other things that really put a bad taste in my mouth about this is his recollection of what happened upon meeting Christina several months after the exorcism in that church.
Here's the thing. I am much more inclined to believe people than you guys are. It's a really cool story. It seems he needed some evidence.
Friedkin and his producer traveled from Rome, whatever, to meet Christina, the subject of the exorcism, and her boyfriend. They had this meeting in this church that he sets up to be some monumental confrontation. And it's weird because he films absolutely everything, like at awkward times, keeps that camera in people's face.
Which is what a documentary
exactly. is. Exactly. I'm not saying he shouldn't be doing that, but now he doesn't. And then we get this voiceover with, not even Unsolved Mysteries, like Travel Channel ghost documentary still zoom ins of chairs and things in this church. To the best of my recollection, this is what happened. And he relates the story of how he showed up and Christina and her boyfriend basically threatened he and a producer with their lives and their family's lives.
She was rolling around on the ground rolling like a snake, knocking over chairs, speaking as the devil, saying that she wanted the world to see this footage and her boyfriend wanted it deleted.
Right. Which, so, it's cool. I think it's really interesting. It's just unfortunate that
this documentarian left his camera in the car.
Yeah.
It's just the whole movie.
It's transcredulity.
Like, there's a lot of potential. But
and just to give the context for filming that, the reason he was back in was because he was supposed to be filming her 10th exorcism.
Oh.
She bailed at the last minute. At least according to the story in Vanity Fair where he details the whole thing. So there's more information in that.
Interesting tidbit. We have now been talking about this movie for as long as the movie's runtime.
It depends on how I edit this. But yeah, a short documentary, 1 hour and 9 minutes.
Yeah, so not long enough to get in depth, but long enough to be boring.
I just didn't think there was anything else.
There's nothing there.
Nothing else in this documentary.
There was nothing in this documentary.
The exorcism ran unnecessarily long. It was peppered with partial subtitles, which I found very irritating. It showed to me that he didn't put a lot of time or effort into this.
Can I read his description from Vanity Fair of the interaction in the church? Because it gives more detail than the movie did.
Sure.
Which I thought was kind of cool. So interestingly, he calls her Rosa in this instead of Christina. I think her name was Rosa Christina. You know, Italians have multiple names.
Yeah.
That's a thing. Rosa's 10th exorcism was set for the 4th of July. I was determined to record it and follow the story to its end, however long it might take, and to whatever conclusion. I arrived in Rome on the 3rd, only to learn that Rosa had canceled her appointment with Father Amort. When Francesco talked to her on the phone, she told him she didn't feel up to it.
Francesco's the producer.
Right. She would reschedule when she felt better. Francesco asked her if, since I had come to Rome, we could film some background footage with her to show what appeared to be her otherwise normal life with her family, friends, and her boyfriend, Giuliano. She agreed, and we set a time to meet in Rome on July 5th. The day before, I visited Father Amort again at his residence. He emphasized that he believed Rosa was one of those rare victims of demonic possession, that her infestation was made worse by the curse from her brother and his girlfriend. They didn't get into that in the movie either, which I think is kind of interesting.
Hmm.
Father Amort told me that even when Rosa appears normal, she experiences mental suffering. After her 9th exorcism, there was some improvement, but she is not liberated. Perhaps it won't be me who is successful with her. There's someone who plants the seed and someone else who harvests. And Jesus reminds us it is he who sets people free, not the exorcist. After 2 hours, he seemed to tire. We hugged, he gave me his blessing, and I left. I turned back once again to see him smiling and waving. Rosa canceled our meeting only to call back and reschedule. She said she'd meet us in Rome, then called back a few minutes later sounding angry and frustrated to beg off. Then late in the evening, she called to apologize. She claimed she had forgotten the date of our meeting, but told Francesco she was looking forward to seeing me again. She asked if we could meet her in Alatri, a small town close to where she lived 90 miles southeast of Rome. We set out for Alatri at 11:30 in the morning. Rosa said she'd meet us at 1:30 in the public park on top of the town in front of the Basilica. The drive took 2 hours on the A24 and A1 motorways. We passed flat tires dotted with bundles of rolled hay. Alatri is a historic village perched on a hill overlooking red-tiled rooftops and distant mountains. The village dates from the 2nd millennium BC and is surrounded by massive Etruscan walls pieced together without mortar like a giant jigsaw puzzle. The narrow
And we did see those. Yeah. It is quite beautiful. Cool.
The narrow alleyways and cobblestone streets are lined with small houses, many of them adorned with oil paintings of the saints under glass. It's obviously a religious town, okay? Here's his timeline. 1:30, Rosa hadn't arrived. 1:45, the heat was infernal and there was no shade. The temperature was over 100 degrees with no humidity. He said 120 in the shade. Right, I think he might have gotten a little bit,
Yeah,
he was a little heat-addled.
Yeah, we went into the basilica. The wood-paneled interior was the shape of a cross with three aisles and a raised transept across the nave. It was dark, cavernous, and empty. 2 o'clock. We went back outside. A half dozen young boys lazily kicked a soccer ball around. There was no other movement. Francesco called Rosa on her cell phone. She answered quickly, sounding angry. "Where are you?" she screamed. "We're at the park," Francesco answered. "Where are you?" "I'm where I told you I'd be. I'm at Santa Maria Maggiore, the church in the town square." Drenched in sweat, we walked back down the steep road a quarter of a mile. The limestone church of Santa Maria Maggiore dominates the public square. Completed in the 5th century, it was built over the ruins of a temple to Venus. A 4-story bell tower adjoins the pointed facade. 2 smaller arch doorways flank a larger center door under a rose window. We entered the door on the right at the base of the bell tower. For the next 15 minutes, we were trapped in a living nightmare. Just within the entrance, Rosa, her mother, now this was left out of the movie too, Rosa, her mother, and Giuliano were sitting on the dirty plastic thrift shop chairs. Her mother was crying.
Why is he leaving anything out of the movie?
Right, because I know.
I don't understand. Had room for it.
I don't get this. Yeah. Giuliano stood over Rosa, holding her tightly to the chair, one hand around her neck and shoulders, the other around her waist. She was growling and screaming, struggling to break free, but this was not Rosa. It was a monstrous, ugly, despairing creature with a gravelly voice filled with anger and anguish. It was the voice of the damned. She was far worse than during the exorcism, but there was no priest to control her behavior. The church was otherwise empty but for this tableau of horror. Francesco and I watched in stunned silence as Rosa slid around on the floor, pulling Giuliano and the chair with her. For a moment, she stared at me with a malevolent grin I will never forget. Then came a sad, painful moan as she collapsed into a trance, then a terrifying roar that burst from her whole body. The color drained from her face. Her disheveled hair flew wildly in all directions. Foamy spittle formed on her pale lips. She made a shrill wailing sound over which her mother yelled at me in Italian, "Give us back the film." See, so here it's the mother yelling for it.
This is just so ridiculous. I don't understand these cross details.
And the story is puffery. It's just...
Well, I think it's a really cool part of the film. So Rosa's shouting, "No, no, I don't want it." She collapsed again with a tearful, exhausted expression. Now Giuliano says, "Your film must never be seen." Francesco was breathing with difficulty and was trying to translate everything quickly.
Can I stop real quick? I think the tagline of something being like, "They said they didn't want this to be seen," is always like a really interesting selling.
Yeah.
Thing. You know, it's like Zach Bagans' documentary where he's implying that maybe you'll be cursed by watching this film.
Friedkin says, "I tried to appear calm, but I was terrified. I said, I'm not going to give you the film." Giuliano, "I know why you want to show this, to make a famous film about Satan. You don't care if showing it will ruin Rose's life." Mm-hmm. Rose's attempt to break free from Giuliano's grip were directed towards her mother, not me or Francesco. Her leaps and thrusts became more violent. I told Francesco to tell them there was no film. It was a video on a little card. I thought they would have no idea what I was talking about, but Giuliano smiled and said, "Oh, it's an SD card. You must bring it here and we will burn it." "I'll never give you the video," I said, raising my voice. "I made it to show the work of Father Amort." Mother says, "We'll get lawyers. We'll sue you and Father Amort." And Rosa says, "I am Satan." Yeah, and she keeps screaming she wants it to be seen. I walked out into the scorching white heat. Francesco followed a few moments later, and I could hear the screaming inside before the heavy wooden door slammed shut. We said little as we drove back to Rome, fear and sweat clinging to us.
Okay, and if this was in the documentary, I would like it.
Right, I know. See, what's weird to me is, like you said, it's not like he was short on time.
No.
The story that proceeds here makes more sense than what was told in the movie.
You know what would have been even more interesting is if they told this in a non-linear way and maybe opened with this, if they had the footage and then went back. It's just like filmmaking. I'm not a filmmaker.
It puts the focus of the story on where the real story actually is, the mental illness of this woman and how it's affected her family.
Well, he doesn't. I don't believe he believes in that. He, in his discussions with the doctor, came out with opinions that seemed like he was very much cherry picking what he wanted.
He was not listening to the doctors.
No.
Yeah.
And that was what he chose to leave in the conversations with the doctors.
I don't think this was edited.
This is a pretty cool detail too. Apparently the most recent exorcism with her, there was a clergyman performing it. And in the middle of the ritual, the clergyman called out to the spirit of Father Amort for intercession. Rosa/Christina started screaming and said, don't call him. So I mean, that's kind of a cool thing too. Like, mental illness takes a lot of forms, and if you live in a country where exorcism is a very common and socially acceptable thing, it makes sense that it would take that form.
Just assume that I am mentally making disparaging comments about a culture that fosters that.
Well, but I also think that if that voice was a real voice that was emanating from that woman, it's scary as hell. And I hate Friedkin for not even discussing it. To me, it makes it look like a fraud, even if it isn't. And that really bothers me.
You know, my opinion on this is Friedkin is still riding the high of The Exorcist. And the feelings that came out of that, the public opinion on exorcism was a lot different in 1973. You know, people didn't question things like they do now. So I think that he made this film almost expecting the audience to react in a similar way
right.
to how they did in 1970.
Like a bunch of slack-jawed dumbasses.
Exactly. Well, I mean, I'm ready to buy into it. That's what the voice did for me. I just need it addressed. Address the freaking elephant voice in the room.
Address
good God.
The Friedkin voice.
Yeah.
Friedkin. And
we've
talked
a lot about the short, bad movie.
Kelly,
yep.
How do you feel overall?
Well, I'm disappointed for all the reasons I've already stated. No use in going over them again. But I was intrigued. I think that it's an interesting story. And whether you believe in exorcism or not, knowing the root of it and how it's handled in today's society is interesting, because if nothing else, it's a social commentary mm-hmm. and a study of how people deal with their fears and their mortality. I would give this movie 6.1. I wish I had a camera in this church scenes happening.
God.
If that voice is real, it's a 9.
Really?
If it's that's why I'm doing a 6.1, because if the voice is real, it's a 9.
It's a poorly made film.
Oh, God.
But it's scary. If the voice is real, it's a 9. And if the voice is fake, it's a 3.
You weren't serving the tedium like Byron and I were.
No.
Well, you know.
Okay. Byron here. Bad, poorly made film. Poorly scripted. We didn't even talk about the camera shots. Friedkin's framing is falling
and
into itself.
He films himself too.
Yeah.
He like holds it out in selfies. Style.
But then they also show that there's another cameraman. They have a B camera rolling almost the whole time. The way they choose the shots, what they've chosen to put in this movie... Could I make a documentary? Am I a documentarian? Because the only good thing that came out of this movie is the inspiration I felt. The barrier to entry to become a professional filmmaker is more obvious than ever. I give this a 2.
Wow!
I wish those SD cards did get burnt. Okay. How about you, Sam?
I hated this movie. fucking hated this movie. This was not a documentary. This was a hack job by an obviously mentally failing, formerly great director, writer. This movie.
Well, I think we've gone over the edge here.
Failed at being a documentary. It failed at being a feature film. It was too long to be a short, but thank God it wasn't longer.
How about that?
That should be on the poster.
The most terrifying thing about this movie, there is a civilized nation that still conducts 500,000 exorcisms a year.
Okay, no, it's not that many exorcisms a year.
Whatever it was too many. I give this garbage 1.9, and I hope Friedkin doesn't get to make anything after this.
And those are thoughts on the devil and Father Amort, which you can hunt down, I'd imagine, somewhere.
Wow. You watch. It's going to come out that voice was real, and then you're going to feel
no,
bad.
It wasn't.
If it was, then I guess I will have to reassess. But I want to know what you think about this movie. Let us know if you've seen it. Tweet us at Fright Day on Twitter. Or leave a comment below this episode in the show notes at FrightDay.com. Or you could send us an email at contact@FrightDay.com. It could be about this movie. It could be about any movie we've watched. It could be about anything at all. Facebook.group. Ooh, this could be a heating up scenario over there. They're the best people.
Yeah.
Instagram @FrightDay. It's the same as our Twitter. Next week, The cleanse.
Yeah, people are really looking forward
to this. Voted
on
it.
They did vote on it. There's no downrange this week. We might stumble into that at some point, or I might let the writer's room talk about it.
Ooh.
That, who knows? But if you like this show and want to help us make it even better, grab something spooky at shop.frightday.com. And if this show isn't enough for you, and you find yourself craving more Kelly, or more me, or more people you don't know yet, the writer's room people, they're great.
But you should know them.
You should at this point.
You'll like them.
Patreon.com/FrightDay is a thing for you. Lots of shows, bonus episodes of Captain Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracies, Byron's Serial Corner, The Writer's Room, and Cinema Autopsy. And most helpful of all, leave a review on iTunes. That's the best way to get us in front of new eyes, inside of ears. This person did just that. This is from Not Nearly Cute.
I bet they're cute.
Probably adorable. The best thing to listen to with your ears ever. 5 stars.
Aww.
I found Friday when I was looking for a new podcast to listen to while I was playing video games. It's becoming my favorite podcast ever. So nice to listen during the summer when my friends are lounging by the pool and I'm hiding in the shade, protecting my pale, pasty skin from UV rays or on long road trips.
This person and I would be friends.
I've also become a tad obsessed with conspiracy theories thanks to Captain Kelly. I recommend this podcast to literally anyone and everyone. Thank you so much. That's very nice of you to
Aww.
Say.
I have a quick apology here.
Oh.
We received a really, really, really nice email a long time ago, and somehow, probably mostly me,
Director of Communications?
Yeah, I failed on this one. So, David, thank you. We loved your email. It was really, really kind. Very heartwarming. Appreciate it. Look for a reply here very soon. Mm-hmm. But anyway, apologies and thank you. We really do try to hold up our end of communications.
Yeah, and
sometimes
that's
we fail.
contact@frightday.com is that email address. Kelly, where can people reach you specifically?
You can find me on Twitter at Kelly Frightday. You can email me, kelly@frightday.com.
I am at Sam Frightday. Email me, sam@frightday.com.
And I'm at Byron McCoy on Twitter and Instagram. Byron@frightday.com is my email address. Next week is going to make me thirsty. The cleanse is going to be a blast. But until then, Frightday, that is. Until next Friday. I'm Byron.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Sam.
Been listening to an Audio Wool original produced by Byron McCoy. Theme music provided by Cemeteries. For more programs like this, visit audiowool.co.